Come on, do it. Listen now. Listen to the Patrick Madrid Show.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, we're back. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. I have got a great thing for you. Whether you're married or not married, Father Rocky has a book called Marriage Insurance, 12 Rules to Live By. And it's now available for free. We want to give it to you for free. The book gives concrete advice about what can and should be discussed before you get married and what should be done after getting married to make sure that you have a more stable, joy-filled, and long-lasting marital union. It's a quick read with practical tips that can be put into practice right away. So get your copy of Marriage Insurance, this book by Father Rocky, absolutely free by going to relevantradio.com/marriage. Easy. There's no shipping. There's no handling. You don't pay a penny, and you'll get the book in the mail. And this is available only for a limited time. Now, some things to make you think about going to do this. I mean, free is good, right? You get a free book. So why not go to relevantradio.com/marriage? You want some lasting love. You want a happy, holy marriage. You can have a strong marriage. You can have a happy marriage. You can have a permanent marriage. And by reading Father Rocky's book, Marriage Insurance, 12 Rules to Live By, you'll discover how. Again, absolutely free. And we encourage you to share this link with family members. You just go to relevantradio.com/marriage, and you'll be able to share that with them. And you may ask yourself, yeah, well, what does a Catholic priest know about marriage? After all, Catholic priests don't get married. Well, that's true, but for more than 20 years, Father Rocky has ministered to countless married couples, and he's helped them through various difficulties and seasons in their relationships before, during, and after getting married. They've shared with him their problems and their successes. He's seen what has worked and what doesn't work, and he wants to share these keys to success in marriage with you. So once again, it's free. You don't pay a penny. Just go to relevantradio.com/marriage. 888-914-9149. I want to touch upon a story that we discussed briefly yesterday, and I think it was a caller who called in. And once we're done with that, we'll come back to the phone calls. And that is, and I'll just share it with you, this is from the Times of Israel. Rabbi Ratzon Arusi, the chair of the Chief Rabbinate's Commission for Dialogue with the Holy See, has expressed concern over recent remarks by Pope Francis about Jewish law. According to the report in Reuters, Arusi sent a letter to the Vatican requesting clarification of comments the Pope made to a general audience earlier this month. On August the 11th, Pope Francis spoke at the Vatican about the first five books of the Bible, known as in Hebrew as the Torah. The Pope referenced the biblical story of God giving the Torah to the Jewish people, saying God offered them the Torah, the law, so they could understand his will and live in justice. We have to think about that. We have to think that at that time, a law like this was necessary. It was a tremendous gift that God gave his people. Later in the speech, Pope Francis said, the law, however, does not give life. It does not offer the fulfillment of the promise because it is not capable of being able to fulfill it. The law is a journey that leads toward an encounter. For those who seek life need to look to the promise and to its fulfillment in Christ. So the head of the rabbinical council wrote this letter to Cardinal Koch, K-O-C-H, I don't know how he pronounces it, but let's say Koch. And his Vatican department includes a commission for religious relations with Jews. And the rabbi said in his letter, in his homily, the Pope presents the Christian faith as not just superseding the Torah, but asserts that the latter, the Torah, no longer gives life, implying that Jewish religious practice in the present era is rendered obsolete. He said this is, in effect, part and parcel of the teaching of contempt toward, and that's in quote marks, toward Jews and Judaism, that we had thought had been fully repudiated by the Church. And the rabbi asked the cardinal to convey our distress to Pope Francis and to ask him for a clarification to ensure that any derogatory conclusions drawn from this homily are clearly repudiated. And Cardinal Koch's office said that they had received the letter and considering it seriously and reflecting on a response. All right, well, this is a tempest in a teapot for this reason. Pope Francis is right. This is correct. The law is not going to give you the eternal life. The law is not going to give you what it is intended to point toward. And Pope Francis is correct. This is this This was imperfect and incomplete, and it was given by God to the Israelites as a preparation for what was coming and would be perfect and complete, namely Jesus Christ and the new covenant that God has established with his people. And it's extended as fully to the Jews as it is to anyone else. In Jesus Christ, the fulfillment of the law has taken place. So, yes, I mean, it's surprising to me that this is even an issue. I mean, just read the New Testament. Read what St. Paul says on this issue in Galatians and in Colossians, for example, where he talks about how these demands of the law and the requirements and the restrictions and the animal sacrifice and all of these things, they all passed away because they had been fulfilled. They were necessary in their time, but they were indeed rendered obsolete by the coming of Jesus Christ and his fulfillment as the Messiah of Israel. By his death on the cross, he accomplished in his own saving work on the cross what all those gazillions of animals that were sacrificed could only symbolize. And yes, this encounter that Pope Francis speaks about, the encounter with Jesus, that's what gives life. And that's the gospel that was preached by the apostles. That's the gospel that was preached by Jesus. So don't let this trouble you. There's nothing in this that is contempt for Jews. And I take anti-Semitism very seriously, and I deplore it. And I oppose it, but this is not that. This is not anti-Semitism. This is not contempt for the Jews. This is, if you ask me, this is love for the Jews by saying your Messiah has come. And he wants to give you all those things that the Torah was pointing toward and symbolizing, and it's here. It's all yours. Come and get it. Join us. So this is love for Jews, not contempt for them. And just to put not too fine a point on it, if you talk to the rabbis, what are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you Jesus isn't God, they'll say. This whole Jesus story, that's a myth. That didn't happen. If you consult the Talmud is the, you know, this very large body of rabbinical commentaries on not just the law and the prophets in the Old Testament, but on other teachings and things that various rabbis have given and that have been commented upon by later rabbis. And, you know, there are stories in the Talmud about Jesus being a golem. A golem, and I'm not talking about the character in, Lord of the Rings? A golem is basically a zombie, a dead person who can fly and do all kinds of bizarre things. And Jesus is characterized as that in the Talmud. That seems contemptuous to me. But I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. I mean, if a given rabbi or a given Jewish community has contempt for Christ, okay, you know, I wish you well. I pray for you. I hope you receive Jesus. But I'm not going to write a letter to your rabbi asking for a clarification. One reason is because none of this is new. This has been there on the book, so to speak, for 2,000 years. So as you read this story, this is not anti-Semitism. This is not contempt for the Jews. This is not, it's none of those things. This is just the gospel. This is what Jesus himself said. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You know, you have heard it said, or Moses told you, but I say to you, Jesus said. So Jesus demonstrated his authority over the law and his fulfillment of the law in himself. I mean, I could go on, but there's no need to do that, right? Because it is what it is, and it should be understood in context, and there's no need for this controversy. That's my take on it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Chris in Feasterville, Pennsylvania, where no one goes hungry. Is that right, Chris? Nobody goes hungry in Feasterville?
That's absolutely true, Patrick.
Good. Well, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much, Patrick. I just have a question, Patrick, regarding part of the gospel passage that was read this morning during the morning mass on EWTN. And it refers to the fact that no one knows the day nor the hour, not even right. the Son, but only the Father. Right. I presume that's referring to the human nature and the divine nature of Jesus, the human not knowing, but the divine knowing. And my question is, if that's true, wouldn't the human nature still have to know what the divine nature knows?
Bingo. You answered your own question, but you're right. This is from Matthew chapter 24, verses 42 through 51. So I'll just flesh it out a little bit more, Chris. So in the incarnation, you have the second person of the Blessed Trinity, the Son, who shares everything in common with the Father. Everything the Father has, the Son has, in terms of his infinite knowledge and infinite goodness and love. And all those divine attributes are common to each of the three persons of the Trinity. No one is more God than the other. And in the incarnation, God himself united to himself a perfect human nature. And as I'm sure you already know, but for the sake of discussing it, the perfect human nature includes a human will, a human mind, human body, all those attributes that are proper to a human person and are contained in the human nature. All of those things are united to the divinity of the second person of the Trinity. So he is a divine person, but he also operates in and through, and you might think of his human nature as an instrument. If you were to write a letter and you took up a pen, the instrument that you would be using would convey your thoughts. And in a way analogous to that, Christ's human nature is instrumental to God's revelation to us in the fullness that Jesus gave it to us. So that being the case, it is true that in his human knowledge, he had to learn things. So he had to learn how to walk. He had to learn how to tie his sandals. He had to learn how to help his dad in the carpentry shop. He had to learn all the things that human beings learn over time. In his humanity, he had to do that. Now, the church fathers who are commenting on this mystery, they point out other analogies such as his divinity and his humanity coinciding in the same person, you know, with a body and a soul, could be understood something similar to how you can look up in the sky and see the sun right there. You have the beatific vision. You can see the sun shining down upon you. And everything you do in life, if you're walking around outside on a very nice sunny day, it's illuminated by the presence of the sun. So the sun is analogous, the sun in the sky is analogous to Christ's divine nature. His human nature is analogous to you walking around, but you see things very clearly. And whenever you want to, you just look up and you can gaze directly at the sun and it won't hurt your eyes. So what that means in this case is that Jesus is speaking about in his human knowledge, his human limited human knowledge that he doesn't know. Now, this passage is like some other passages where it refers to Jesus going to my God and your God, to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And some people say, well, how can Jesus have a God? If he is God, how can he have a God? Well, he's referring there to his human nature. So you had it right, Chris. That's the essence of the answer to this question. But I think it deserves a little extra fleshing out, don't you think?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Patrick. What I just find a little confusing is, you know, Jesus being a God. I know he has a human and a divine nature, but that Jesus wouldn't know the end. That's still a little bit confusing to me.
Well, let me put it this way. We see the instance where Jesus is passing through a throng of people. They're pressing against him on every side. And the woman who had the hemorrhage, remember, she was hemorrhaging for many years, wasting away, and she reaches out and touches just the tip of the tassel of his cloak. And he stops and he says, "Who touched me?" Now, as God, he knows everything. There's nothing that can be known that God doesn't know. So as God, he knows that. But in his human mind, he didn't necessarily know that. Mm-hmm. And so there's a dramatic example of where we see the limitations of the human mind right next door to the infinitude of the divine mind. And it's mysterious for us because there's nothing else we can compare this to. We don't have anything that we can point to and say it's like that. So we do the best we can with analogies. I'll recommend a good book to you, Chris. A book is called Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheet. He has a lengthy section on this exact topic where he takes it up at greater length. And I love that book. I think people who've read it have had the same experience. So check that out, Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheed. Thank you. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Frank now. Frank in New York City. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. God bless you. I have a two-part question.
Okay.
I need you to answer both parts for me. One is basically a question. One is a comment, and I think you're going to find it very interesting about Mary's sinlessness. My first part is there's a growing number of consensus among evangelicals that the word impute, like Abraham believed the Lord and it was imputed to him as righteousness, is not found in the scriptures. In the sense, at least, that evangelicals mean it, that once they get saved, they can't lose that salvation, that grace. Okay. You know, deemed to him as righteousness, accounted to him as righteousness, I guess that's
reckoned.
Fine. But impute, you could find the word impute, but not to the connotations that they attach to it. Could you give me a list or some evangelicals that do, in fact, acknowledge that? I know George Eldon Laird does and N.T. Wright, but do you have any others that you could add to that list?
I'm afraid I don't have a list, you know, that I've compiled or seen compiled. I'm not aware that anyone has done that. That's a good question. The term that we typically see used in English is reckoned. You know, imputation has a kind of a specific connotation, as you know. And reckoned is seems to me a little bit broader in its way of being understood. So I can impute bad motives to somebody. It happens to me all the time. People impute bad motives to me. But that is just, that word is kind of restrictive because it means that whether it's true or not, it's still being attached to you. It's still being reckoned unto you or imputed to you. And in the case of justification, as Martin Luther propounded it, he reckoned, and I think this gets to what you're saying here, he said that it was pure imputation, that this is the alien, forensic, extrinsic righteousness of Christ, which is being applied to you, the sinner, and it's not really in you. It's not. It hasn't changed you. It has sort of covered you. And so it's imputed to you. But it's not really in you. It's not, you know, it's not having that purpose. They would separate that and they say, well, that's sanctification. That's a separate thing. Catholics say no.
Right.
Justification and sanctification are the same thing. And they're like two sides of a coin. So, but you probably know all these things already, Frank. You're a very erudite guy.
Yeah, well, that's basically, it's extrinsic. It's alien righteousness. It doesn't inherit in us. But now, Patrick, tell me what you think of this. I never heard anybody say this. I mean, you know, when you were saying before about the sinlessness of Mary with the word kekaritomene, right?
Yes.
It comes from the Greek root karatuo, right? Mm-hmm. That's found only one other place in the Bible, in the New Testament anyway. And it's found in Ephesians 1:6. The word is ekaritosen.
Right.
And it's referring to people that have been saved through baptism. They've been completely washed, and all of their sins have been taken away, original and actual sins. So if they were to die at that moment, they would go straight to heaven. Mm-hmm. But that word, the only other place it's used in the Bible is in Luke 1:28, when the angel uses that word in reference to Mary before Christ was even born. So I think this is a great argument proving that Mary had to be sinless even from the moment of our conception. Have you ever heard that argument before?
Yes, there's a book called Refuting the Attack on Mary that was published by Catholic Answers, I don't know, 30 years ago by Father Mateo. That's a pen name. And he talks about that. So Ephesians 1, verse 6, to the praise of his glorious grace, which he bestowed on us in his beloved. And that's where that kekaritomene participle appears. And we see it again in Luke 1:42. Blessed is the fruit of your womb. So I guess the argument that you're saying specifically is because in Ephesians 1, 6, these are people who are in heaven and they are completely grace-filled, that would be the way to demonstrate that the same use of this term in Luke 1:42 connotes the same condition, the same fullness of grace in Mary. Is that the argument you mean?
Yeah, basically, and they don't even have to be in heaven yet. they could have just been baptized, so to speak. They could have been just washed. And they're free from the Council of Trent actually referred to those people as immaculatus, immaculate.
Right.
So if Mary had this before Jesus was even born, I mean, come on. You know, I mean, it's self-evident.
Yeah. I think that if you read that book, I just want to mention for the benefit of those who are interested, that book called Refuting the Attack on Mary does have a whole section on that question. Now, it doesn't necessarily phrase it the way you just did, but it concurs with the point that you're making. So you might find that interesting.
All right. Now, Patrick, let me ask you this. When you said before about imputation, they separate in justification. Protestants have made a deliberate distinction, if you will, and never existed before, between regeneration and justification.
Mm-hmm.
They have done that at the time of the Reformation, which cannot be done. They can't be separated, but that's what they did. And yet they say justification saves the person, but it doesn't change them interiorly, which is impossible.
I agree with that, Frank. I totally agree with that. I'll have a word or two to say about that on the other side of this timeout, but thank you for the phone call. Nice to talk to you again. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Who's this, Cyrus?
This is Wellness, I think.
Wellness. They sound energetic.
Yeah, they got a lot of energy.
Okay,
so I thought it fit the show. We're rocking and rolling today.
I would agree. We do that every day.
Right here. Yeah, what am I saying?
888-914-9149. Let's go to Giancarlo in Westchester County, New York. Hi, Giancarlo.
Hello, Patrick. My question is, I am a Catholic. I grew up Catholic. I went to Jesuit high school. All around Catholic growing up, right? I lost the faith as I became older, and I've been coming back, but I've come back going to Orthodox Church, right?
Okay.
And my question to you is basically, it's almost like if you want to walk me off the ledge, is I'm considering chrismation into the Orthodox Church, and amongst the arguments I've seen is just seeing how, for example, our Pope is saying that taking the vaccine is an act of love. When I'm a person who had COVID, I don't have to take the vaccine. I don't trust the vaccine at all, amongst other things. But I guess I would ask you, the question is, basically, you want to walk me off the ledge?
I mean, okay, if that's what you want. I can't push you one way or the other. I certainly won't push you off the ledge. But your reason for being Catholic should have nothing to do with what Pope Francis says about vaccines. I mean, it's a non-issue when it comes to whether you're going to be a Catholic or not. The only reason to be a Catholic or not a Catholic is whether or not it's true, whether or not this is the church that Christ established. And I believe he did, without any hesitation. I can assure you of that. And the Eastern Orthodox churches, they left communion with the Catholic Church, and the facts of history demonstrate that overwhelmingly. I know that they'll tell you exactly the opposite, and I'm familiar with the polemics, and I'm aware of the arguments, and I've even had discussions with Eastern Orthodox believers. So nonetheless, I would say that, and only that, is why you should get off that ledge. If Christ established the Catholic Church, which he did, then that's where you belong. He said in Matthew 28, go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them. You know the chapter and verse, Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20. So he didn't say, you know, I'm going to start Christianity, or I'm going to start a group of, Jesus didn't start a federation of like-minded, more or less the same churches that are autocephalous and independent of one another, and they, you know, go in and out of communion with each other in the Catholic Church. He said, I'm building my church. This is my church, and I want you to enter into it. So that's the only good reason why you should be a Catholic because it's the church that Christ established. And everything else is just, it's just extra. You know, you can consider the polemics and the arguments about the filioque clause or the authority of the Pope. And these are age-old discussions that have been argued over for many centuries, and you know, they'll probably keep arguing over them until Jesus comes back. But personally, you know, are the smells and bells nicer in the Orthodox Church than the typical Catholic parish? Yeah, aesthetically, sure. But that's not a reason to leave the Catholic Church. I mean, if you were in Africa worshiping in a mud hut as a church, it's still the church that Jesus established, and that's where I belong. I believe that's where you belong. So I'll have to leave it up to you to get off that ledge. But one thing I would recommend to you, actually two. One would be read the book called Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism by James Licoudis. His name is spelled L-I-K-O-U-D-I-S. He himself was a Greek Orthodox believer, and he became Catholic. And so you might say he was on that ledge and he got off when he became Catholic. But in the book, he explains his reasons why. So if that interests you, if you want to see why somebody would come in the other direction, I think you'll find it at least eye-opening and enlightening. The other thing I would suggest would be to seek out a Byzantine Catholic church. So the Byzantine rite in the church, and there's sub-rites within that. So you have the Ruthenian Byzantine and various other versions of it, but look for a Byzantine Rite Catholic Church in the greater New York area and attend their divine liturgy. And you know what you're going to find? You're going to find essentially what you would be seeking aesthetically in the Greek Orthodox Church. You're going to find that essentially in the Ruthenian, or not necessarily the Ruthenian, but in the Byzantine Rite of the Catholic Church. And if you were to decide to go into that rite, then you would remain in union with the Catholic Church. You would remain in communion with the Bishop of Rome. And you would be receiving all those things that you would otherwise get in the Catholic Church, but you would be experiencing them in the manner that you would see at a Greek Orthodox Church, minus the controversies. So that would be my suggestion, Giancarlo. And maybe after a few months go by, if you've tried some of these suggestions, I'd appreciate it if you call me back and let me know what you think, and then maybe we could take it up again from there. Thank you. Let's go to Valentina now in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Hi, Valentina.
Hi, Patrick. My question is about, I'm reading that book, Interior Castle.
Ah, good.
That you've recommended a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
In the first chapter, St. Teresa says something like about praying. I don't know if I should just read the excerpt or
sure.
just describe
go
it.
Go ahead and read it. Go ahead and read it.
So she says, if someone prays without awareness of who she's talking to, what it is she's asking, or who is doing the asking and who is being asked, I do not consider it prayer, no matter how much her lips are moving. And then she says, if she gets into the habit of addressing the Magnificent One as if he were her servant, never questioning the manner in which she is expressing herself, merely letting whatever pops into her head fall out of her mouth, filling words she has learned by simple repetition, she is not in prayer. And when I read that, I was like, do I do that? Or what does that mean? Because I say the rosary every day, and then I spout off my intentions before that. So now I'm like, oh, am I doing that? So I guess I was just reading that, and then I guess wanting to refine my prayer and wondering if I was doing what she was saying not to do.
Yeah.
Or what that meant.
Well, let me put it this way. If the shoe fits, wear it. And I would say the shoe probably fits most all of us, at least at one time or another when our prayers are perfunctory and we're just rattling off the prayers, like say the rosary, for example. If you're just rattling it off in a perfunctory manner and not really thinking about it, then yeah, that would describe you. That would describe me. When I pray that way and it's not really thoughtful and it's not really a conversation with God, I'm just saying, like she said, saying words or moving her lips, that is what it amounts to. So how about that for an incentive to be more thoughtful and more meditative, right, when it comes to praying? That's such a great reminder.
Totally. And that's why I called, because I was worried that it became more like rote, and then I was like, so is there any tips to pray it more mindfully when it has become so memorized, I guess?
Well, you're, first of all, you're reading the book that will give you those tips. So keep pressing on. Are you early in the book right now? Are you in the outer courtyard or have you moved into the building yet?
So I have read up to the third dwelling. So I'm in the house. Okay. Or the castle, but I'm not really, like, that far. I'm at the part where she says, like, you know, the orderly life, and they live pretty well orderly, and then, you know, if something, I feel like I kind of, like, am there, personally, and in the book.
And that's a good place to be. It's not where you want to get to. You've got more distance to go, don't we all? But that's a very good place to be, as opposed to out in the outer courtyard where the rattlesnakes are, right?
Yeah.
So what are some suggestions? I mean, I'm not the right person to answer this question because I'm not a paragon of prayer. So I have to learn, just like you, from others who know a lot more than I do. I look to people like St. Francis de Sales, and he has a very good book, which you should read perhaps after this one. It's called Introduction to the Devout Life. And in the book, he's writing to a fictitious woman. Pilothea is her name. It's a pseudonym. And it's as if he were giving her spiritual direction. So you can imagine yourself as Pilothea. And so St. Francis de Sales, as a bishop, is instructing her on matters like prayer and fasting and how to pay attention and how to not let your emotions carry you away. So these are really helpful, practical things that he teaches in that book that maybe after you're done with this one would be the next step, you know, to read that and to get those. But let me share with you some of his suggestions. So among other things, a very simple thing, and I remember I never did this, or at least I never thought consciously about doing this until I read some of these spiritual masterpieces. Something as simple as when you walk into a church, just stop for a second and recognize you are standing in the very presence of God Himself, the creator of the universe. And that can be an overwhelming thing when you stop and you put yourself intentionally in the presence of Almighty God and start expressing your love for Him, then that will set the tone for how you experience the Mass. And things like that, I think, are really the practical ways of going about this, beginning with when you pray, just pause and put yourself in the presence of God. You're already in His presence. You're never out of His presence, but make yourself aware that you are in His presence. You know, it's like pressing the button and all the lights in the room come on and you see that you are standing there alone with God. So one practical thing that I have learned from these other masters in prayer, which I am not, would be just start with that. And then Saint Therese of Lisieux, for example, she describes it as, And you know, she was in the tradition of St. Teresa of Avila. So she learned from St. Teresa of Avila, who came a few centuries before she did. But she said that prayer is just as simple as being a child talking to your beloved father. When St. John Vianney was asked, well, when you pray, like, what's happening? And St. John Vianney said, I look at God and He looks at me. So he had reached that deep level. That's the innermost mansion, by the way, Valentina, in the book you're reading, where you've moved to the level of contemplation. You just contemplate God. You're not meditating. It's not discursive. You're not rattling off prayers. But you've reached the point when you get there where you're just beholding God. And He is, as St. John Vianney said, He's looking, He's gazing upon you. You gaze at Him, He gazes at you. And so much communication can take place silently. I'm guessing because you have a baby on your hip that you're married. And so, you know, as I am. So you don't need anyone to explain to you how one look at your beloved husband without any words, one look from him to you and one look from you to him, or a long gaze can convey a whole lot of communication in a single glance.
Yeah.
Right? Without words. That's what we're all trying to get to in terms of prayer. And getting there is the hard part, but you can get there. And hopefully I can get there too, because I'm trying to dog paddle my way in that direction as well. But these are all ways that you can begin to kind of push away the distractions and focus your mind. And I think that's where it starts.
And then this would be something too, like I could achieve while saying the rosary too. Cause I guess I'm just wondering too, like, what is the place of prayers like that in achieving that kind of.
Right. Well, those prayers, like, the Our Father. So you notice that when Jesus was asked in Matthew chapter 6, Lord, teach us to pray. He didn't say, all right, well, close your eyes and try to get free of temptations. And then whatever's in your heart, just say that. He didn't say any of those things. I mean, there's a place for that kind of prayer, obviously. But what he said was, when you pray, pray like this. And then he gives the Our Father, which encompasses all the different modes of prayer. So the prayer of petition, the prayer of praise, the prayer of thanksgiving, the prayer for others, and all the ways in which we can pray to God, that's all contained in this microcosm of the Our Father. So I think of it this way, and I'll have to leave it at this, but I think of it this way. Those prayers, which are very important, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, praying the Rosary, Divine Mercy Chaplet, in an analogous kind of way, those are like the lane stripes on a highway, on a freeway. They guide you. They protect you because you're not going to start swerving into someone else's lane. You're not going to go off the road. Mm. They're there to help you in those ways. But you'll notice that you're moving in a certain direction. So the car that you're in is going toward your destination. And these lane stripes are there to help you get there, to help guide you. So I think of those prayers as being extremely important because they do that for me. And they'll do that for you.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, when you pray, please pray for me. Lord knows I can use it. And I do appreciate it. Thank you. We'll take a break and we'll come right back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And I will be right back with you right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Don't you like getting free stuff? We have something free for you that's really good. This is a book by Father Rocky. It's called Marriage Insurance, 12 Rules to Live By. And we're offering it to you right now while supplies last, absolutely free. And by free, we mean free. So you don't pay anything. You don't pay shipping. You don't pay handling. And this book will come to you in the mail. Here's some of the fine print. The book gives concrete advice about what can and should be discussed before getting married and what should be done after getting married to ensure a more stable, joy-filled, and long-lasting marital union. It's a quick read with practical tips that can be put into practice right away. Get your copy of Marriage Insurance for free at relevantradio.com/marriage. Again, no shipping or handling charges. It's absolutely free, but it's only available for free for a limited time. So if you want a loving, happy, lasting, holy marriage, you can have that. But you have to do certain things and not do certain things. And Father Rocky, given all of his years as a priest and hearing confessions and giving counsel to married couples and engaged couples, he's got a lot of insight into this issue. Even though he himself has never been married, he's an expert on the topic in terms of giving advice that really works. And that's what this book will do. So maybe you have kids who are on the road to marriage and you want to make sure that they're properly prepared, or maybe you're getting ready to get married, or maybe you've been married for 30 years and you'd like to make your marriage as good as it possibly can be. Well, this is the book for you. And again, it's free. Just go to relevantradio.com/marriage, 888-914-9149. We'll go to Colleen in Southern Minnesota. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. Say, I have a quick question. My 14-year-old daughter asked me this at bedtime last night, and I couldn't answer it. She said, when Christ was born, obviously he became man, and his DNA came from Mary. And she said, and where else?
Just Mary. Yeah, so his DNA came from Mary because there was no human father involved in his conception. So Our Lady handed on to him his DNA. Now, you know, what does that mean in terms of chromosomes, X and Y chromosomes? And what does that mean? You know, we don't know. That wasn't revealed to us. What was revealed to us is that Jesus received his human body from Mary and Mary alone. So it's a puzzle we don't know all the answers to, but at least we know that much about it.
Perfect. I just wondered because Joseph, I mean, he was from the line of Joseph that he would come, but really just not any physical piece of that. Correct?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand the question. Could you restate that for me, please?
Well, I mean, isn't he from the line of David, which would have been Joseph, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yet not physically from that line is really
right.
What
so,
we're understanding.
Yeah, so that kind of gets into the question of the two genealogies, the one in Matthew and the one in Luke. And the Matthean genealogy traces Jesus' legal connection to King David, the royal lineage that he has legally through his foster father, St. Joseph. And the Lucan genealogy traces Jesus' lineage back to King David through the bloodline of Mary. So there's a legal genealogy, and then there's the bloodline genealogy. And they both coincide with King David. So that's, I guess, maybe the easiest way to answer that question, Colleen. Is that what you're referring to?
Thank you so much. Yep, that's it.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
Super duper. Thank you. I appreciate that. I have some stuff I want to share with you before we go to other phone calls here. First of all, things are ratcheting up in Afghanistan. I want to go through a few things that you need to know about. Number one, I was looking at the sheer amount of military equipment that was left by the Taliban, or I'm sorry, left by us to the Taliban. They now have this. And it's just astonishing when you consider the amount of material. I'm talking about helicopters and airplanes and armored personnel carriers and machine guns and pistols and RPGs and you name it. I mean, it's just a treasure trove of American military equipment that has been left there that, of course, the Taliban have picked up. And not just the Taliban. You've got ISIS. They're in on the scene. There's a story here in the news just this morning about a suicide bombing that just took place in the last couple of hours. And according to, let's see, looking at Reuters here, this was at the airport in Kabul. A suicide bomber blew up, 13 people killed, it looks like. There are people wounded, three Marines have been wounded, at least in terms of this. They don't know yet how many total people, and ISIS has claimed responsibility for this because ISIS announced some hours ago that they were going to attack, and they did attack. So this is happening right now in the midst of this already insane, chaotic situation where they're trying to get these people out and get them on planes and getting them going. So things are changing even as we speak. This is not a static situation here. Just to give you an idea of some of the implements of war that have been left behind for the Taliban. So we left them 110 helicopters, the Mi-17 and the MD-530 helicopters, 60 transporting cargo planes. You know those big, big cargo planes that we fly people out of Kabul airport? We left 60 of those, C-208, C-182, C-130s, T-182s, etc. We left 20 light attack airplanes, A-29s. Those are the Tucanos that I mentioned the other day. We left 18 intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance airplanes for a total. They now have an air force. The Taliban now has an air force, courtesy of the United States, of 208 aircraft. What other goodies did we leave for them? In the category of rifles, so we're talking about carbines, the M4 carbine, the M16, the AK-47. Sniper rifles, you name it, 358,530 of these rifles we left in the hands of the Taliban. We left them 126,295 Glocks and what others, like a 9mm pistols. We left 64,363 machine guns, 25,327 grenade launchers, 12,700 shotguns, nearly 10,000 rocket-propelled weapons, And the list just goes on and on. We left them with 16,035 night vision devices, state-of-the-art night vision, 120 radio monitoring systems, 22 ground-based operational surveillance systems. We left them with drones. We left them with surveillance balloons. I mean, our military is formidable and powerful because we have all of those things, and now they have all those things. And I have a feeling those are not going to stay in Afghanistan. Humvees. It is staggering. So that's going on. In the meantime, in addition to that, now the Christians there, they know that they are in really big trouble. They're in very dire circumstances right now because the Taliban has the biometric data to be able to look people up and to look at fingerprints and things like that. There's a story this morning that comes from the Catholic News Agency about desperate Christians in Afghanistan who are being turned away at the Kabul airport with time running out to rescue civilians fleeing the Taliban. Afghan Christians and others whose names appear on the U.S. government lists of qualified evacuees are being turned away at the airport in Kabul. Faith McDonald, director of advocacy for an Anglican nonprofit that helps people in situations like this, says, "I was told by contacts from various groups working to rescue those still in danger in Afghanistan, who must remain anonymous, that the State Department, at least at a certain point, was not implementing the lists that they required the organizations to compile, even though they have sent them multiple times. It seems at present as if no one is getting any priority unless they have some sort of special connection inside the airport." So the Christians now, what are they doing? Well, it's being reported that as the Taliban are searching for people door to door now, they're going door to door and they're commandeering people's cell phones. They're looking at what apps they have. They're looking at their contacts. So the Christians, as it's being reported in The Hill, are turning off phones and going into hiding. With the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, governments around the world are frantically making plans to rescue as many at-risk Afghans as they can. And it goes into some of the statistics of how many different countries are taking. Afghans Christians are estimated to number between 10,000 and 12,000. The vast majority of them are converts from Islam to Christianity. For decades, they have largely practiced their faith underground, as conversion is considered a crime punishable by death under Sharia law. Yet, since the Taliban's fall in 2001, the Christian community there has not only been growing, it has become emboldened, in part because of the modicum of security that was given by the U.S. presence on the ground. In 2019, as the number of children born to converts grew, dozens of Afghan Christians decided to include their religious affiliation on their national identity cards so that future generations wouldn't have to hide their faith. Only about 30 Christians successfully made this change before the Taliban's takeover this week. Now the United States' highly criticized withdrawal has left Afghan Christians with no choice but to join with those who cooperated with the U.S. and Afghan governments in an attempt to hide. The memories of public executions, floggings, and amputations of Christians and other religious minorities under the Taliban's previous rule remain vivid. As the Taliban is reportedly already working to track down known Christians on its list, some local church leaders are counseling their communities to stay inside their homes, even though they know the best and perhaps only long-term hope is to somehow flee the country. Other Christians are reportedly escaping to the hills in attempts to find safety. Now, hey, I understand what it's like to be inconvenienced for your faith here in this country. And we all know what it's like to have the parishes closing during COVID. But this is whole orders of magnitude worse compared to any difficulty that you or I face when it comes to our own religious freedom or anything like that. They are so far beyond that in terms of the danger that they're in right now. Some Christians on the ground have expressed that with the takeover of Kabul, they expect to be killed mafia style. Although some reports say that the Taliban is already conducting targeted killings of Christians and other minorities found using public transportation, they're also executing anyone with Bible software installed on their cell phones. So they're having to get rid of their cell phones. They're having to, at the very least, turn them off. They're hiding in their homes. Eventually, they'll be hiding in caves, and they will be killed as quickly as they can be found. Now, oh, by the way, just in case you were wondering, what are we doing at this? I just want to point out that the U.S. government has issued a strongly worded statement against the Taliban because the United States is deeply worried, not about Christians, but about Afghan women and girls and their rights to education and work and freedom. And so in this strongly worded statement, which I'm sure the Taliban are going to stop and say, uh-oh, the United States is sending us a strongly worded statement. We're in trouble. We better stop. I mean, I don't even know what to say about this story. It's so absurd. And did previous presidents, Bush, Obama, did they say, let's get out of it? Yeah, they said that. But the way this is being done is so wrong. The Biden administration, the Daily Caller's got an article here about the Biden administration telling people who want to leave Afghanistan that they're going to have to pay at least $2,000 if they want to get on a flight out of the country. So they're charging these people money to save their lives to get on board an evacuation flight if they can even get to the airport, which now they can't. And ISIS has just done a suicide bombing at the airport. I'll be right back.